This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you, in part, by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. For the true crime that's worth your time, delivered to your inbox each weekday, visit bestevidence.fyi and subscribe. That's bestevidence.fyi. And if we have 2,000 paid subscribers by August of next year, we'll be covering the Theranos trial in person. Just like Dominic Dunn, but taller and alive. That's just $5 a month, folks, so tell a friend. And while you're up, tell her that the episode is starting right now.
It was perfectly normal to have parents like we did. It was perfectly normal to live in a shed. So I was never questioning anything. Because what is normal, really? Normal is what you know, and normal is what your family is.
Episode of The Blotter Presents this week, as I review the latest iteration of a predictably compelling podcast franchise, Bad Batch, a crime noir, this one Sarah Perry's After the Eclipse, and a documentary about twin mind and malleable memory, Tell Me Who I Am, that just hit Netflix. All that and pod business? Perfectly normal. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 118. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, where I look at how true crime is told and sold. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I am on my own this week to review three different properties, a podcast, a book, and a film. We will get into it, but first.
In local news today, bees.
You may have noticed that the -blotter.com blog is looking a little funky, a little 96. This is a PHP problem, evidently, and I have to either fix it or move the archives to the new, easier-to-remember-and-say URL, theblotterpresents.com. It's probably going to be the latter, and that's probably going to be a few weeks away because there's a fair bit of other shties going on here at Blotter HQ. I apologize for that, and thank you for your patience. If any of you in listenership has expertise in exporting WordPress blog archives to Wix or something similar, and you want to recommend yourselves, this is a problem I am fully prepared to throw some money at. DM me on Twitter at Blotter Presents or email editorial@the-blotter.com. That email should still work. Emphasis on should. You may also have noticed that the Blotter's Facebook page went bye-bye recently. I'm trying to streamline all the related offerings around here is the primary reason. Bless Mark Zuckerberg has to do with my shit is the better is the secondary reason. If you are looking for a spot to discuss everything we talk about, either here or on the Best Evidence newsletter, your best bet is Best Evidence. I'm going to be posting more open threads over there in coming days. Even if you're not a paid subscriber, you can still participate in those. But once again, paid subscribers get even more stuff. Think it over, $5 a month, $55 for the year. It makes a great, easy-to-wrap gift for true crime fans. Any other technical problems or questions, at me at any of the places that I have mentioned above. Now it's time to inject some vetted stem cells into this episode. With our first most wanted section of the week, I'll be talking about the new podcast from Wondery, Bad Batch. Here's the case file from Wondery's landing page, quote, "Patients are offered a miracle cure, but instead they end up rushed to the hospital in critical condition. The race is on to track down what went wrong with several patients in Texas before more people get hurt. The trail leads to a stem cell company with a charismatic CEO, and to an entire multi-billion-dollar industry where greed and desperation collide." Sidebar, that sounds like all of them. Laura Beale, the award-winning host and reporter of Dr. Death, returns for this six-part investigative series from Wondery. End quote. If you enjoyed Dr. Death, or you enjoyed Bad Blood or any of the related Theranos product, this is the Wondery combination of those two cases, and it's the typical expeditious, but careful, introduction to various players and biomed legal concepts. Beale's ability to lay groundwork and provide texture without dawdling or overloading the listener with information right up top is key to the appeal of these podcasts. Bad Batch does seem a little bit longer on lead up than Dr. Death did, though, longer on foreshadowing. Still, there's plenty of that, and plenty of it suggesting that someone near the top of the stem cells food chain in this story suffers from ethics deficits in the same narratively satisfying way Elizabeth Holmes did.
As Livion's compliance officer, part of her job was to make sure GeneTech, the company that supplied Livion with its product, was following the rules. She didn't like what she saw. Equipment wasn't being properly calibrated. She couldn't find records of environmental monitoring.
So I wanted to see proof. Like, okay, you say you're doing it. Where's the proof? Can you show me records? They said they were doing it, but I wanted to see, you know, the proof that they were actually doing it.
Aaron reported it to the government, to the Federal Food and Drug Administration.
The FDA didn't follow up with that report until June of 2018. And it was good information. I mean, if I was them, I would have gone out there, you know, that week or at least that month, at least that year. But they waited.
Why do you think it took them so long?
I think they're just understaffed. I honestly think that they probably would have loved to go there, but they just don't have the manpower to, like, respond to every little deviation that gets filed with them.
That sounds familiar, right? Same corners cutting and excuse making as Elizabeth Holmes. Same disingenuous paper shuffling as Anna Delvey. The ingredients for a finance cocktail are all lined up on the counter here, including the insider expert who's more than happy to explain how obvious the con is if you just look at it from the right angle.
Pharmaceutical company in the world will tell you, you know, you have to have qualified suppliers. You have to have trained people. So that's number one why they can't use that excuse. Your people have to be trained in what the regulations that apply to the industry are.
Their defense is like, well, we didn't know and GeneTech was hiding this from us and they were fraud. Is that an excuse?
No, can't be. You need to tell your suppliers, I need cells that were produced using good tissue practices and good manufacturing practices. And it's also a requirement that you audit them, that you have objective evidence that they're following those rules. The last guy who hands it off to the customer is the gatekeeper of the safety and health of the customers. They cannot say that it's not their responsibility because the guy that supplied me was doing it wrong. How are they testing this material incoming to prove that it is what GeneTech said it was? So none of it holds any water at all.
These are exactly the sound bites you want and expect from a story like this, from this storytelling concern. For whatever reason, like I said, Bad Batch's pacing does feel a bit more stately than Dr. Death's did. Maybe because the immediate outcomes we hear about aren't as floridly serious. But this isn't exactly a complaint. The rhythms of the podcast are effective. It just seems like it's taking longer to get to the real meat of it. The clips we've heard that seem to accelerate the listener somewhat towards the real bad actors in the story are from the second episode of 6. And the primary scam engine, at least as far as I can tell from 3 episodes in, Livion CEO John Kay, isn't brought to the fore as a fake-it-till-you-make-it striver until, like I said, episode 3. I mean, look, once he is brought to the fore as such, once Beale is less opaque about his role in not just a series of tainted injections, but in various other compromised business dealings prior to founding Livion, John Kay is the perfect contemptible subject slash target.
And my life was literally turned upside down. And from that point forward, I don't think anything will ever match the emotions that I went through at that time.
What does a 10-year-old boy feel like when you see your parents splitting up?
I think you go through all the stages of grief, just like if you were to lose someone. You go through sadness. You go through anger. You go through blaming one or the other for doing this or that.
The inclusion of this is interesting to me. This clip and the surrounding information, which is about John Kay's parents' divorce when he was 10, seems to be either an attempt by John to contextualize his single-minded pursuit of material success based on his father's far wealthier California lifestyle after he left the family, coupled with John Kay's need to prove himself to the absent father, Maybe it's an attempt by Beale to position John as blaming his parents' divorce for his Ponzi scheming. Or it's both. Whatever the intent was, my notes were like, son, my grandfather died when my father was 10, and you didn't see Dave Sr., who went through the actual stages of grief at the age of 10, out there robbing Peter to pay Paul. I don't mean to minimize the effects of a split on kids, but there are things that you can blame on that. Interpersonal infidelity, trust issues, SEC violations? Fuck out of here. Later, Beale gets tape from a former investor of John Kay's, one who is happy to go on the record but doesn't want his real name used because, he says, he's not entirely sure what John might do in response. This is probably an overabundance of caution, but, quote, Steve's rendition and Beale's editing in of examples of how guys like John squid ink the answers to the simplest questions in order to avoid scrutiny or responsibility is so brisk that John should be pissed.
He went on with this big explanation how it works.
I want to sell some of the commission or the premium. Instead of keeping $30 a month, let's sell off 10 of it so that an investor can put an investment in and own part of the premium, and we'll take that money and market to all of these insurance. So for an example, you have $1 million.
And there was a time where he was just using lots of big words and lots of definitions and details that most average people wouldn't understand.
Global Corporate Alliance is a management company that manages all of the finances for NACA.
And even if you ask, you know, I don't really understand this, can you explain how that works? The answer is still, it's still in this tangent of over detail and words that the most people don't use in their everyday sentences that you don't have the definitions for, things like that. So it's a little confusing when he explains these things. That's how I felt when he would talk to me.
So what they did is they went out to several different insurance carriers. There were three or four.
It was an investment based upon insurance overages, medical insurance overages, that you could get paid back. You put in a certain amount, and then you would get payments back in return.
It's this asshole says what sequence, which really put me in mind of being on the floor at Comdex and the guys in the gingham shirts and pressed dungarees squeefing on about liaising content valuations and sector coverage that let me know I wanted to finish out Bad Batch, and I'm happy to recommend it to y'all as well. It's only 6 episodes, 3 of which have already dropped as of this writing. They're all about 30 to 40 minutes long. And while it's not quite the ride Dr. Death was, even the slightly slower opening episodes are perfectly well built. Wondery and Beale are good at these stories, and I'm glad, because there's no shortage of them, apparently. And I just like to put it out to the universe that I would welcome a 6-parter or a 16-parter on Michael Swango. Dr. Death 2. Now this is how you bring shame to the medical profession. Just put it on a tee for you. Hit it. Our second most wanted property today is Tell Me Who I Am, a documentary that I believe dropped a few days ago on Netflix. Could also just be when I heard about it. Here's the case file from the Google Books page about the book on which the documentary is based. Quote, imagine waking up one day to discover that you've forgotten everything about your life. Your only link with the past, your only hope for the future, is your identical twin. Now imagine years later discovering that your twin had not told you the whole truth about your childhood, your family, and the forces that had shaped you. Why the secrets? Why the silences? You have no choice but to begin again. This has been Alex's reality, a world where memories are just the stories people tell you, where fact and fiction are impossible to distinguish. End quote. In 1982, 18-year-old Alex suffered a traumatic brain injury after a motorcycle accident. His twin, Marcus, was the only one he recognized upon waking and was the one to help him navigate their odd, at best, home life once Alex was released from hospital. The shed they lived in instead of the main house, the verbally abusive father, the girlfriend Alex didn't recall. Director Ed Perkins takes us through their story, First, Alex's version of the rebuilding of his past, then Marcus's, then the part where Alex's insistence that he know the truth, and Marcus's aversion to putting either his twin or himself through trauma again, come together. To call this true crime is not really accurate, although crimes were absolutely committed. To say much more about it is not really possible without spoiling it, because the point of Tell Me Who I Am, I think, mostly, is the journey to information, and the suspense created for Alex and the viewer, almost unbearable at times, by Marcus's decision to withhold it. At no time while I was watching Tell Me Who I Am was I tempted to Google to find out the facts of the case or what the book contained, which, as regular listeners know, is a recommendation in and of itself for true crime properties for me. This movie could, I suppose, be a short. There is a lot of atmospheric shot making, creepy photos of the buildings that stand in for their childhood home, with flaming barrels or birthday cakes in front of them at dusk, God's eye shots of twin beds containing various configurations of curled up or absent twins. But all of it works. What Tell Me Who I Am is asking us to contemplate is not just the horror of what happened, but the horror of being unable to know what happened, which, in its way, is at the heart of all stories in this genre. Our need to know, really a need to control, manage, avoid. It's contemplating stories, the ones we tell ourselves and each other, whether memory is reliable ever, how memory is built.
Marcus showed me a photograph of the two of us on holiday, and it looked nice, and we were, you know, typical boys building sandcastles on a beach. So I just presumed that's what we did every year. He showed me photographs, and I joined the dots. He would give me a photo, and I would construct a memory around that of two happy boys on a beach. What I was doing was actually re-implanting his memory.
Marcus and Alex are well used to telling their sides by now, so there is something of a craft to this foreshadowing, these careful references to pattern recognition. As the film goes on and we switch perspectives, Marcus remains something of a Virgil for Alex and for the audience. It's the circles of hell that drop into focus.
I tried to not make anything up. I just left stuff out. If he'd started challenging me on everything, the whole thing would have broken down and he would have worked out very early on what was really going on here. But you've got to remember, he'd lost all memory. So I wasn't being challenged at any point about anything. So if I said we went on a family holiday, we went on a family holiday. Period. He didn't ask again. And I did that all the way up until he was 32 years old.
There are many talking head comments like this, and while sometimes it's unclear how this whole Rube Goldberg memory construction worked, Alex's reintroduction to his friends, for instance, is a bit odd. Like, wouldn't they all have known he'd had this terrible accident? Why would Marcus need to brief Alex on who is who in that case? Couldn't the friends just remind him themselves? Was it a matter of defending against their accidentally breaching the bubble Marcus was creating for Alex around their wretched childhood? The outlines of what really occurred remain vague for so long, and there's so much repetition of the central premises, that you would think Tell Me Who I Am would land as a bleak, portentous, tiresome tone poem, but each twin's take on how much truth Alex should know is convincing, and the shadowy reenactments lend a project that should, on paper, be an unworkable Frankenstein of three identical strangers and, honestly, my sweet Audrina, a sickening tension. The resolution, if you can call it that, isn't satisfying, exactly. The timeline, particularly given that there was a book, is a little too collagey for that, never mind that the events being disclosed with such halting anguish don't allow for satisfaction. Only the putting down of a great burden, and only for a time. But Marcus's teary note to camera that, after years of telling nobody what happened, including himself, he's now telling strangers, which in a way he and his twin were to each other for decades, is bracing.
Now I'm telling you, I've never met you all. I don't know who you are, but you know who my mother is. And you know what she's done is wrong. And that's very powerful. And I need that. We all need that.
My esteemed colleague Stephanie Early Green asked if I'd seen Tell Me Who I Am a few days ago, and when I had watched it, I sent her a damn you Salazar text. Jokingly, I do thank her for the rec, but this is not an easy thing to watch. Sometimes, though, that's the point. Sometimes we need to witness, in the way that Leaving Neverland or Strong Island or Surviving R. Kelly asked us, in exchange for giving us knowledge and information we think we want, knowledge and information we think is power or inoculation against evil, these works ask us to divide the knowledge up amongst ourselves and carry its weight for a while together. And it's worth doing. Tell Me Who I Am is a Netflix original. You'll find a link in the show notes. And again, without revealing too much, I will issue a content warning. And I will say that within about 10 minutes, you will be able to tell what the warning is probably for and whether you ought to continue. Proceed with caution. Our last segment is a cold case. Not that cold. It's from 2017, so it's more room temp, but it does concern a case that remained cold for some time. It's Sarah Perry's After the Eclipse. Here's the case file from the New York Times review of the book from when it was published. Quote, when Sarah Perry was 12, she saw a partial eclipse. She took it as a good omen for her and her mother, Crystal. But that moment of darkness foreshadowed a much larger one. 2 days later, Crystal was murdered in their home in rural Maine. It took 12 years to find the killer. In that time, Sarah rebuilt her life amid abandonment, police interrogations, and the exacting toll of trauma. She dreamed of a trial, but when the day came, it brought no closure. It was not her mother's death she wanted to understand, but her life. She began her own investigation, one that drew her back to Maine, deep into the darkness of a small American town. End quote. That last sentence oversells the investigative aspect and the small town masks heart of darkness aspect quite a bit. After the Eclipse is much more a document of grief and isolation. Perry's custody journey after her mother's death is all the more heartbreaking in how compassionately she renders the shitty, lonely, wrongheaded decisions made over her head and without her input. One of her aunts in particular, I would cross the street to earbox still. After the Eclipse can be a little bit overwritten. In the early going, I think partly as a sort of emotional throat clearing before the supremely difficult tasks to come, Perry overdescribes a police station. Quote, a flagpole rises from a closely shorn strip of dull winter grass, end quote, as well as the officer raising the flag outside. The actual eclipse is not dwelled upon long, fortunately, but eclipses, like baseball and fucking, are difficult to write about crisply because all the references and comparisons come, so to speak, in the very language of the literal thing. And because this event, the eclipse, is in the title, and forms such an important emotional divider for Perry, she can't avoid capital I imbuing, and she doesn't try. At the same time, there is sometimes the sense that the first draft or drafts of a passage were much more poetical, incantatory attempts at description that were then ruthlessly pared back. And I kind of like that we see that part of the process. The mourning, the depression, and then the rendering of these things down to essentials. And Perry's description of ear witnessing her mother's murder, then knocking on endless doors progressively further from their house, trying to wake someone up to help her because she couldn't get her phone to work. I don't quite know how to describe the intensity of it. There is a conceit in it of a second self being born that I'm not entirely sure works, but the overall effect, the reader wanting to rush through, but also looking over her shoulder at the details behind her. It's the same way that I read my grandfather's autopsy, and I will note here my grandfather was not murdered, but because he died at 47, With pretty much no preamble, after lunch in the coat room at work, the medical examiner got involved as a matter of Philadelphia statute. But it's the way that you look at evidence of a partner's cheating. It's the looking and hoping not to find. It's fear of seeing and fear of missing something holding hands. To recreate that sensation in an account of something that does not involve the reader personally or anyone that she knows personally slash directly is really quite something. It's artful reporting, and it's very hard to do. In another scene, Perry is talking about the prickly fear that so many of us are always either feeling or waiting to feel, consciously or not, when men outnumber us or can overpower us, or we are beholden and less in some other way in a situation. Quote, I could see him laughing at me. In that sort of situation, only the man can laugh. Only the man knows whether something terrible is about to happen. And even then, he might take himself by surprise. End quote. Perry has a way of placing something you've known for years just a few degrees over so that you can know it all over again. It's quite well done. After the eclipse in the timeline, after the event that blotted out almost all light, I'm sure not coincidentally, the writing settles into an assured, compelling pace with an occasional grace note that makes you look around you. And once I had time to sit and just read it, I finished the last three quarters of it in an evening. I'll provide an Amazon link at the end, and if you'd like to click on that, I'll make a penny or two. But I read it via the public library, and I'm sure you too can find it there if you're using the Libby app. Brooklyn Public Library definitely had it if you're not feeling spendy. The full title is After the Eclipse, A Mother's Murder, A Daughter's Search. And if you liked Leah Carroll's Down City, this one is a good bet for you as well. That's it for this roundup edition of The Blotter Presents. Coming up on the podcast, Season 2 of The Dream, the Sundance Limited series The Preppy Murder, and more. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram. And at Eve Beatty's and my True Crime Review newsletter, Sing It With Me If You Know The Earl, bestevidence.fyi. If you like the podcast, I'd really love it if you could tell a friend and give it a 5-star rating on your podcast app. If you don't like the podcast, I would really love it if you would keep that to yourself. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.